My name is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order, Episode 1 of Season X. Today we're going to talk about maker culture, hacker culture, and, well, a little bit of an event report from me about an event that I attended. And we'll do a demo or two. We'll do one demo for the noobs out there, and that'll be font, installing fonts and things like that. And for everyone else, or anyone else, Krita, the drawing application, the digital painting application. So, let's get started. First, I want to do the fortune of the day, so let's look and see what we get. We get human beings were created by water to transport it uphill. All right, it's time for Noob Corner, which is the time where I tell you something that you probably know if you've used Linux for a long time, but you might not know if you're a little bit of a noob. Today's lesson applies for both Linux and BSD and some Solaris, depending on how you're running it. So it's font installation. And font installation is actually really quite simple. It really is. It's you're going to be pleasantly surprised. But there are a couple of different ways that you can do it. So let's take a look. So fonts. Everyone loves fonts. There are two primary ways that I can think of to install fonts. So I've got a collection of lots of fonts here in this directory. And I'm going to go to the font directory, just in Dolphin. And I can look through bunch of fonts. A lot of these are already installed. I don't really recommend installing like every font that you ever find. Certainly I have a folder of about 2,455 plus fonts. Don't install all of those all at once because that will slow down the start time for applications that use fonts, which is lots of applications, because an application generally wants to read in the font list and generate a menu for you so that it doesn't have to do that on the fly. So while you're using it, that makes font menus a lot faster, but it makes the startup time a lot slower, and you run a risk of clobbering font names and things like that. So be a little bit selective in terms of what you actually have installed on your system. That's my advice. Okay, so I'm locating a font, and I'll just, in Dolphin, I'll just click it once, and this is KFontViewer is the name of this application. You can do some interesting things with this. Of course, the default phrase that it shows you the preview in is just a usual, a common kind of phrase, but you can put in anything so that if you need to see something specific in that font to sort of make the call about whether you like that font or not, you can do that. You can view extended sets if there are any. It kind of depends on the font designer as to whether or not you get lots and lots of different font set. It doesn't look like there's a whole bunch of extensions to this one, but in some fonts you'll see things like accented characters, different currency signs, and so on. So let's assume we like this. The very simple process of installing it is clicking the install button. You get two choices here. You get, well, three really, but we'll assume that we don't want to cancel. So two choices. One is to install it on a system-wide basis, or a personal, just for personal use. I used to recommend system because I always thought, well, someone might create a user on my computer and then need to use my fonts. But I kind of did a reality check and realized that I'm the only one using my computer, and so now I just do personal. And the advantage to doing a personal install, which I've just done, is that if you get a new computer and you take your home folder from your old one and put it on your new one, then you get all of your fonts included with it. So I'm going to close that, and as you can see, I've just opened up an application that uses fonts, and now I will look in here for the font that I've just installed, and it should be there, and it's called King Things Rectangle. And by the way, if you don't know the name of the font, or if you know, because sometimes the font file names aren't very useful, but the metadata itself is written right up here at the top in KFontViewer, so that's handy to know about. But as you can see, the font is now on my system, there for me to use in any application that accepts TTF or OTF or any other kind of
normal PostScript font. So there you go. That's the graphical method of doing that. Actually, I'm not going to close that yet. I'll leave that. No, I will close that. Okay, so now I'm going to show you the other way, the more manual way. Now, you can do this either in the terminal or in the GUI. I'll kind of give you a sense for both of them. Either way, there is located in your home folder. It'll vary from distribution to distribution, but certainly on Slackware and BSD and OpenSolaris, even though that doesn't really exist all that much, there's this folder called .fonts. And if I look in .fonts, I see a folder with the beginning letter or number of an installed font name. And I can get there in the GUI by manually typing in the path, or if you, I think you can show hidden folders or something like that somewhere. I don't really do that often, but you can do that, and then you could navigate there manually. I'm just going to type it in because it's quicker and easier. So here's the dot fonts. So we're seeing two views of the same thing here. And if we look in the K section, we should see King Things Rectangle. So that's what we just installed. And certainly we could do this manually as well. So let's look for something that starts with an M, for instance, because I don't have anything that starts with M installed. So I'm going to manually create an M directory. Now, if it already existed, I could just reuse it. And then I will take this one, drag it into my M folder. It's there. And now, if I start another graphical instance, and you do have to restart, like if you've installed a new font and you want to use it, you want to close your graphic application or whatever you're using and then reopen it so that it can read that font file back in. But now that I've done that, I should be able to find multi-strokes, and there it is once again, available for use. So those are two different ways to install fonts. One is either graphical or terminal-based. It's up to you, whichever you find is quickest. And one is purely graphical using KFontViewer.
It actually is simple. I mean, I wasn't lying or exaggerating. It really is quite simple. The bigger issue that I don't want to get too far into, but I do want to make mention of because it's worth mentioning, is font storage, I guess, is what you would say. And that is to understand that fonts, I mean, the only reason fonts aren't a thing for most people in real life is that most people in real life only use the fonts that come pre-packaged with their computer. The minute people get some other application that bundles extra fonts in with the install, most of those people start getting familiar with fonts and how they can break. And fonts are a lot like compiling software in a way. I mean, it's nothing like compiling software, except that when you send out some design or something, if you send the source of that design and you didn't send a font along with that source, then that thing will not look the same on the computer that someone else is looking at it, you know? So, I mean, a lot of this stuff has been kind of built into the packaging up of your thing. Like, if I've designed a flyer, I print it to PDF. PDF pulls in the font along with the PDF, so it's taking care of that for you. It's a bad idea to assume that the application is just going to take care of something for you, and you should get familiar with how to keep track of your own fonts and the fonts that you have used. And believe me, I have done a lot of design work for or layout work. Actually, I'm not design, but well, I've done some design work, but a lot of layout work for Linux conferences, and I've done that before to myself. You know, I've one year I'll design something, I'll forget to bundle a font with it, and the next year I'll open it up to revise it or whatever, and the font can't be found, and it's some horribly named font that I then have to go dig around. I've mostly solved that problem for myself at this point, but it used to happen. It's a thing. It does happen. So if you're a font person, make sure that you keep your fonts in some standard location on your computer, back them up, keep track of them so that when you send out something to someone else that, you know, you can send that font along with it if they don't have that font on their system, or even if you're just for archival purposes. I will often put a font file in the directory of that design, and then I'll archive it and, you know, put it on a backup drive. But that font stays with that thing so that in the future, I'll be able to open that thing, and if I need a font, there it is right in the folder. So just something to think about. Well, I could probably talk about that in greater detail at some other point, but I wanted to just make mention of it now. So I want to talk a little bit about the hacker culture and the maker culture. I don't really have anything to sell you. I'm not trying to convince you of anything. I just really kind of wanted to talk about it because it's been something that I've been involved in, both of these two cultures for a little while, one longer than the other, I guess you could say. And the whole concept of a culture is a little bit weird. You know, I mean, the problem with a foo culture or bar culture is it becomes about the culture. It becomes about the clique rather than the substance of why the group was formed in the first place, if you know what I mean. When I was in school, and this might be different for you, for me, this is how it was. When I was in school, at the school I was at, I'm talking about like school, like when you're a kid, not university. The thing at school was that you didn't ever want to get exposed as a geek or a nerd or whatever. You know, I mean, you wouldn't admit to playing D&D or an RPG game. You would not wear Star Trek lapel pins and color coordinate them with your t-shirt. You would not wear NASA badges on your jacket in the winter. Things like that. Patches. That you would not do that. That would bring down the wrath of I guess the cool kids or whatever. And now obviously geek culture as a thing that exists, you know? I mean, there is geek culture to such a point that there, you know, it's a kind of a package deal that you can sign up for. You know, you go to the websites, you go to the stores, you buy the correct things and you become a geek. It's something that you sort of work toward. And that's the thing, I think, about cultures and groups, is that, since we're talking about geeks, I'll just keep going with geeks, but I think it happens with more than just geeks. But, you know, the old geek groups of yesteryear, they existed because people happened to be interested in the same thing, and so they kind of got stuck with each other because they were just the other people interested in that thing. And then once the group exists, then people join the group in order to become one of the people in the group rather than, you know, organically growing as the group. It sounds like I'm talking about petri dishes at this point. I'm not, but the idea is that, you know, once the group exists, then people come to the group rather than the initial stage of where it was just a bunch of people who happened to become a group, if that makes any sense. And that's what many of these things that we're dealing with now, like the hacker culture, the geek culture, even making, they're at that stage. And I wanted to make very clear, I am not making a judgment call about how geeky or, you know, how whatever any individual in any group is compared to anyone else. That's a very dangerous thing to do. You start comparing geek cred or something like that, and it becomes antagonistic pretty quickly, I think. And obviously, there's always going to be someone geekier than you or less geeky than you. So, you know, you don't want to start making judgment calls like that. That's silly and not very nice. So all I'm saying is that phenomenon exists, that when there's a group that can be identified, then people come to that group in order to be a part of that group. Whereas initially, before there was an identifiable, recognized group, people just kind of accidentally gravitated towards other people who were interested in the same thing. Okay, so that was actually a side note, fairly long side note, about about what I'm going to talk about, which is makers and hackers. So hackers and makers are nearly identical if you think about the drive to do what they do and a lot of the level of skill and the level of the learning curve, all that stuff. It's very, very similar to one another. There's an implied concentration for making to concentrate on hardware, and then for hacking to concentrate on software. And there are obviously parts of that that kind of bleed into each other. So it's not necessarily completely cut and dried, but that's kind of, generally speaking, that's what we say about makers and hackers. The thing about hacking and making is that, for instance, as an example, this desk that I'm sitting at right now is a prefab desk that I purchased from a store for, I think it was $20, it was like a sale, and it is a particle board desk. It's very obviously cheap, as I said, $20, and it's the finish is fake. It's some kind of, you know, laminated texture that they put over the particle board. It's a horrible desk, really, but it serves its purpose. And initially, I actually did want to make my own desk. I am ashamed to admit, that was my initial thought. I thought, well, I should create my own desk. But I was in a new country. I am in a new country. I didn't have a car. I still don't have a car. I don't have tools. I do have access now to tools through a local makerspace, but I did not at the time. In retrospect, I should have waited, but in retrospect, also, I wouldn't have had a desk if I'd waited. So that was a judgment call that I had to make. I'm not convinced I made the right choice, but nevertheless. Now, this computer, the one that you can kind of barely see part of it, I think, underneath this monitor, I built as well. Me and my girlfriend, we picked out all the parts, we bought them, we put them all down on the ground and put them all together. It was a dust-free ground. And we built it. And now every time we sit at that PC, we can feel proud about it. You know, we can think, wow, this is really cool. We designed this thing. We picked out all the parts. We assembled it. We plugged in all the wires. When it didn't work initially, you know, we reseated the RAM. It actually worked initially. But for instance, you know, you might say that. Or we had to test the power supply, and so on. That's something that we made and we can be proud of, and we are every time we use it. If I'd made my own desk, I would sit at my desk and I would think, wow, this is really cool. This is my desk. I made this. I got the timber. I walked it home. I walked it to wherever I could get the wood cut and sanded, and then I built it and made it all by myself. And that would be very cool. You can probably detect all the light levels changing because here in Wellington, New Zealand, the clouds are just, the wind is amazing, and it just really, really shifts everything around. So anyway, as I was saying, so obviously the sense of pride involved in making hardware versus, well, hardware/software, because installed Linux. I mean, it's the same thing, you know? I mean, you don't think of a maker building a PC. You don't think of a hacker building a desk. Or you do, but generally speaking, the public, if you ask them, if you said, I'm going to go build a PC, they would say, oh, you're a real, like, computer nerd, or you're a hacker, or whatever. They wouldn't say hacker, because most people think hacker means, like, a criminal. But, you know, so those are two different sort of worlds that are very similar, that you can get involved in, and you have the same desire to learn how to build something, whether it's a desk or a PC. You require some skill to do it, and you get the same sense of satisfaction once you're finished. Now, the other thing that these two processes have in common is the fact that at some point, like when you start sort of measuring all the credentials that you, all the street cred you get for having done it, at some point, the skill and the independence and the self-reliance kind of, it comes to an end, and it's all about the faith in the tools that you're using. For instance, for a desk, if I was going to build a desk, I'd have to go get the timber. Probably I'm not going to go out to the forest. I'm pointing to my backyard as if though it was a forest. I'm not going to go out to the forest in any direction and cut down a tree and then do whatever you do to a tree to actually make like a 2x4 and so on. I mean, some people do that, and I realize that they do that, and that's very cool. But even those people tend not to make their own tools, for instance. And even the people who make their own tools, for the record, I don't know anyone who does that, they don't mine their own ore, and so on. So everyone, no matter who or what they are, they stop making at some point. You know, they're using a prepackaged asset at some level. Obviously, the computer ones, I mean, I didn't make the CPU, I didn't make the RAM, I didn't make the motherboard, the power supply, the tower. All I did was put stuff that already existed together. Same thing as with a desk. So that, like, you know, judging how geeky someone is kind of a dangerous activity too. To say, oh, I made this by myself, and if you don't make your own thing, then you're not as much of a maker or a hacker as I am. Because, I mean, chances are you used someone else's work to get to where you are now. I just think that the important thing to keep in mind, and the thing that I think both the hacker and the maker cultures would benefit from keeping in mind, is that there's a spectrum that exists. And the spectrum, there's an inverse relationship between what is prepackaged or what has already been done for you versus the learning potential. And I would say roughly that, you know, if you're using something prepackaged or that someone has made, then the learning potential is basically, let's just say, infinity minus one. In other words, the learning potential is as great as it ever was for you doing that activity, except for the part that you didn't do, obviously. And we're giving that arbitrarily a one count. So, obviously, I'm not saying, and no one would expect, that you're going to build everything from scratch, because that's just not, it's just, it is possible, but it's just, that's crazy. So I do believe that everyone ought to do their darndest to make use of stuff that was made from scratch by other makers and hackers. That's the important thing to keep in mind, at least in my mind. It pains me to see people purchasing pre-assembled robot kits. You know, learn robotics. There's a robot. It's already put together. Or people using closed source software to make their, you know, grassroots homemade project, hardware or software. I mean, sure, there are things you're always going to have to use that were already packaged up and bundled up for you. But if you can make sure that as much as possible you're using stuff that a fellow maker or a fellow hacker has made, then you're contributing, if you will, to the greater worldwide universal make. You know, you're not just doing a project, you're building on top of other projects that have existed, and you're adding to that ecosystem, and I know ecosystem isn't the right word, but it's a word. You're contributing to that ecosystem of stuff that people are creating with their, you know, with their knowledge and their creativity. They're putting it out there and you're using it to make something more. And that's really, really encouraging. And I mean, if you're at all interested in making and in hacking on code and stuff like that, then you're probably interested in it because you see the value of normal people being able to do those things. You see the value of it because that it is made by you rather than by generic brand X corporation. And there's, I guess, strength in numbers. And if we're all making things and building upon what everyone else makes, then that's a big deal. And that's very supportive of one another. And it gives strength to the movement, if you will. So contribute to the worldwide maker project by using things made by others, whether it's software or hardware, and make it known that we don't need corporations really to be productive or creative, and that we can build upon each other's work. That was a cat. Let's take a look at Krita. Krita is a really, really cool application. Ask anyone, they'll tell you. It's what I call a material emulation software. I think what most people call it is just digital painting, because that's what it kind of excels at. So Krita helps you draw on a computer as if though you were drawing with, you know, actual pens and inks and pencils and paintbrushes. So let's take a look at that and learn a little bit of how to use it, because it's a lot of fun. Oh, and I'm going to need a Wacom tablet. And if you want, you can get a Wacom tablet as well. I just have a cheap little $99 bamboo Wacom tablet. It just works out of the box with Linux, because Wacom, I happen to know, has a driver developer employed so that they write drivers for Wacom and publish them. And you can use them right out of the box with Linux. So let's get started with this.
So I've attached the Wacom tablet. The Wacom tablet is simply recognized on Linux. It just works as long as you have a halfway decent kernel in your distribution, which really most do. I have not encountered one yet that doesn't recognize a Wacom tablet out of the box. But for extra options, you can go to your system settings, whether it's KDE or GNOME or whatever. Go to your system settings. You might have a section dedicated to Wacom tablets. So in this case, it's a submenu or a subpanel of the input settings, and there's my graphic tablet. And as you can see, it is distributed by Wacom. It recognizes what tablet I have plugged in. That's the bamboo tablet, which is correct. It's got a bunch of shortcuts I could define. It has properties of my stylus versus the tablet, and even the touch sensitivity and the orientation. It's a pretty good, and you can create different profiles if you have different, you know, if you're one of those power users who uses it for lots of different things, you can do that. Now, that might not be automatically loaded in your distribution. It just depends. I mean, the Wacom tablet will work pretty much no matter what. But if you want the extra options, you'll probably need to install a Wacom tablet configuration panel. And that, for Slackware at least, is in slackbuilds.org, which I've copied their entire tree down to user. Ports, USR/ports, and it's in the system category under Wacom Tablet, and it's a pretty simple install, and it is from the KDE apps folk. It's extra gear, and so that makes it sort of work really smoothly. To be fair, now I'm launching Krita. To be fair, I've used my Wacom Tablet for a year and never had that configuration panel installed, so it's not really necessary if you're not a power user, but it's got some nice features. It's probably worth mentioning, too, that Krita has recently, like last month, won an award from Imagine FX, which is pretty exciting because Imagine FX, it's a digital art magazine, a printed magazine, and it doesn't really specifically concentrate on free software, open source stuff. It's usually biased a little bit towards the commercial stuff. So the Krita got the Artist Choice Award is very cool, and I thought I'd show you some tips on Krita. So if you want to start using it, you can. So I've got Krita launched now. This is the beginning screen of Krita, and it might be smaller on your setup. I usually start at full screen, but it has lots of useful templates, some comic templates, design templates, which are basically just common page and aspect ratio sizes. But yeah, lots of different ways you can do this. I'm just going to start with a custom document. We'll leave it unnamed for now, and it's 960 by 720 is about 720p. That sounds good to me. Resolution of 100, just to keep things simple. In real life, you would probably want to do more than that. You've got lots of different color modes you could work in. You've got different bit depths, and you've got different color profiles. And right now, we're going to leave the canvas color as white, which will be somewhat significant later when I show you erasing. But here you go. This is Krita. It's probably pretty familiar to you if you've ever used a graphic program. The setup is pretty typical. You've got a tool bar down here over on the left. You've got a tool settings panel up across the top, and you've got all of your little panel, your palettes, or dockers as Krita calls them, on the right. And this is our canvas. So if I just click my stylus button, which upward towards the eraser end. That's button 3, or a right click on the mouse, and I get a HUD. And the HUD allows me to pop up a little circular menu. It's very cool, actually, and it lets me choose between different brushes and even set the color that I want to use. Now, I don't love this color picker in the HUD, so I usually don't use it. I actually prefer the one over here on the right in the Docker. As you can see, if you're looking at the video cast, if you're just listening, I'm just describing it to you, I guess. When I choose a color, it gives me a nice pop-up swatch so that I know exactly what I'm choosing. So I've got this brush here. This is a Bristles Harry brush. I probably don't really want that, but maybe I do. Let's try it. And up here at the top of the screen, there's the size property, a little slider for size. I'm going to make this really, really big, actually even bigger than that, so 300 pixels, because I just want to I want to color in my canvas really quick, because I don't love starting with a blank white canvas. I don't find white usually occurs in nature. Everything's off-white, so I like to start off-white, even though it doesn't make that much of a difference, but that's just some habit I've gotten into. So right now I'm looking at this canvas full size. There's keyboard shortcuts to zoom in or out. You can also use your mouse wheel, whatever you prefer. For keyboard shortcuts, you can go to the settings menu, go to configure shortcuts, and you can customize pretty much everything, and I honestly usually do. The zoom keys I find really unwieldy. Control plus and control minus, when you have one hand on a tablet and one hand on a keyboard, that makes it a little bit difficult, so I just map zoom out to 1 and zoom in to 2, and I just do it that way. You can also define keyboard shortcuts for instance, the eraser mode. That's a very handy one. You just press E. I think that's the default. I don't think I changed that. There are keyboard shortcuts for common tools, like the brush tool, which I don't think is normally B, so I changed it to B, and so on. Lots and lots of different keyboard shortcuts. Just kind of use that, you know, as you will. And then the other thing to be aware of, I guess, is configuring Krita itself in the settings menu. And configure Krita, there are lots of different options. You can go through and try them out. I recommend trying them out one by one, more or less, because changing too much, you know, can often throw you off and get you confused. So I make little changes here and there, try out different options. Mainly the thing I wanted to show you is the cursor shape. So cursor shape currently, as you're seeing it on my screen or not, you're hearing about it, is the brush outline. Now you can also just do a tool icon, you can have a crosshair or an arrow, or no cursor at all, which is weird, small circle, lots of different ways to do this. I leave it on brush outline, but what happens when I make my brush smaller, and that's with a left bracket by default, and that I've kept, I think. Left bracket, when it gets too small and there's a lot going on in the page, I lose track of the cursor frequently. So I have in KDE mapped a little mouse finder so that if I lose my cursor, I can find it again easier. But if you don't like that methodology, just change your cursor. Okay, so we've got brush here. We might as well grab some paint and start seeing what this is capable of. So as you can kind of see as I'm making some strokes here on the page, Krita by default is never really like fully opaque. You know, we often think of brush programs, you know, a graphic program, we think, okay, we're going to select a brush and that's going to smatter a whole bunch of paint onto our canvas and that's it. But as you can see, and even as I'm trying to like sort of paint over what I've just done, it acts a lot more like wet paint or like a blur tool almost, a very biased blur tool. So that's by design, and that's one of the sort of the key features of Krita, in my view. Now what I've just done accidentally is I've moved my canvas unintentionally out of my view, really. And to fix that, you can just press the down button on your stylus. I think it's middle click on your mouse to actually grab hold of the entire canvas and move it around. That's sort of navigation. So what I've done here, for those not seeing this and only hearing it, is I've drawn what I would say approximates some grass, basically. It's just a big blob of green, really. And that'll do for now. We'll add some texture to it in a minute. Next, I'm going to grab some, I guess, sky shades of blue. So again, I could do that with the HUD, which is the up button on my stylus, or I can do that with the color picker over in my dock. Now if I didn't have a dock visible, you can find those in the settings menu under dockers, and you can find all the different ones: brush presets, add shape, layer, channels, advanced color selector. Okay, so now I'm just painting in a sky, and again, it's just like the material emulation is just phenomenal. It looks like, you know, real brush strokes. Okay, so in this case, as you can see, I've painted over the grass, and the sky shouldn't go over the grass. So you might think, well, we could erase. So the erase button is either the E on your keyboard that turns whatever brush you're currently on into an eraser, or you can press the eraser button up at the top toolbar. Either way, as you can see, it changes your active mode into eraser. Now your eraser is textured just in the same shape, in the same way as your brush is. Now I'm erasing, and what anyone watching the video will notice first of all, probably that I'm erasing the canvas itself, where we're getting that weird checkerboard in the background. This is because Krita doesn't have and doesn't want a built-in canvas layer. A lot of programs will give you a default of your first layer has no alpha channel, which is weird. But Krita has, everything has an alpha, so we can erase right through the canvas, which tells you that probably when you first start Krita, you if you're not used to that behavior, you may want to create a layer and lock it and make that your canvas. And you can lock it in your layer's docker by clicking the little lock icon. And then you can't paint on that layer, but you can't erase it either, and then start adding new layers on top of it. So what I'm going to do is undo my sky, and now I'm going to add a new layer with the new layer button, and I'm going to get my blue again. I've got my blue already. Make my brush a little bit larger. Again, you can do that either on the top toolbar or with the bracket keys, so I'll make it large, and then start painting. But I'm still in eraser mode, so Don't let that happen to you. So now I'm out of the eraser mode by hitting E. And as you can see, I'm still going over the grass, but that's okay, because I am going to erase. So now that I've drawn my sky, I'm going to go into eraser mode and touch this up a bit. So the other thing that you notice about the eraser is that it's also, like every other tool pretty much in Krita, it's not 100% either. So in other words, when I erase some paint, it's not like I'm just killing the strokes completely. I'm killing them with about, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe a 50% opacity, something like that, 60% opacity. So there's still a little hint of them. So you can tell that that's not pure, it's not completely gone. So that's a nice feature, because again, it acts a lot more like a physical object. It's imperfect, you know, in a digital world we think, well, why wouldn't it just erase when I tell it to erase? But the goal is to emulate physical stuff, and when you do that, that's kind of what happens. So that's that. I'm going to double click my layer title here and name it just to stay organized. That's going to be the sky layer. And I'm going to just make yet another layer on top of that. Make sure I'm not in erase mode, which I was. And then let's switch over to something a little bit more chunky. So we're in Bristles Hairy right now. So I'm going to go down, and there's a sponge in my brush palette here. There's a sponge texture somewhere. Another place to get, so you've got your Docker over in the bottom right corner with your brush presets, possibly, but you've also got a brush menu right up here at the top of the screen in your top toolbar, and that lists all of your brushes as well. So you can kind of sort through them, and you can actually type in keywords if you know exactly what you're looking for. So if I knew that I was looking for sponge, which I did know, I could type that in, select it, and now I've got a sponge texture. Okay, so I'm going to choose something again a little bit off-white. I just don't love pure white when trying to do these sorts of things. And then as you can see, I'm kind of generating a cloud here just by sort of lightly tapping my tablet. And that gives it a lot more, you know, because of the way that it sort of multiplies over the paint, it gives it a much more realistic, maybe not photorealistic, like I said, I'm not a great artist, but it gives it a little bit more texture to it. And that's what you would expect, too, from a sponge. If you dipped sponge in paint and, you know, pressed it to your canvas, you typically don't get 100%, 100 imprint of your sponge. So, just like in any other graphic application, I can reorder layers by dragging and dropping them. So I've just moved my first cloud layer above my second cloud layer because I wanted my second cloud layer actually to be more in the background. Now I've also got some layer controls like in any other graphic application. So here's the opacity of that layer. So if I decided, well, that's a bit much, or if I want to suggest that those clouds are maybe thinner or maybe more in the background or whatever, I can make those a little bit less opaque, and the other ones will remain completely opaque. And so you've got a lot of sort of control over sort of the digital graphic side of things. I'm going to save this now just to be safe. But actually, before we go away from this, let's look at another brush and add some texture to this grass, just a little bit, just a hint. Okay, so I'm just using, here's a texture hair brush, and this gives me some bristly, kind of pointy, jagged edges that I can use as kind of a texture for grass. So I'll put that on here quickly. And I think we were using the sponge for the clouds, so I'm going to go back to the sponge, and actually, maybe this time, let's use texture fuzzy for the clouds. I'm going to go a little bit darker, that's a bit big, so I'm resizing the brush with the size slide on the top toolbar, and I'm just going to kind of get on the right layer first. I'm going to give it a little bit of gray lining, or I think they call it a silver lining. This is a good example of where you can kind of go into the brush controls, the quick brush controls, up here at the top menu bar, toolbar, right next to the size, you have opacity and flow. So opacity obviously just controls like the literal opaqueness of the brush, whereas the flow kind of controls how much you have to press and for how long in order to get the same amount of paint. And it's kind of nice to just kind of reduce that sometimes to help you sort of do less, as it were, like actually paint less but still get sort of just a hint of what you want. So that's pretty good, just for a hint. I want to show you how to do some things with the brushes themselves. So I've shown you the brush palette with all the presets, but what I haven't shown you yet is the brush edit menu. This is the brush edit menu, right up at the top toolbar next to the brush palette itself. So it's a button with a paintbrush on it, and if you press it, you get more options than you probably ever thought possible for creating your own brushes. Now you can, I mean, if that's something you're interested in, you want to make your own brushes, you can. Otherwise, you can also import brushes. For instance, GIMP brushes are completely legal here. You can import them and use them, and it's pretty nice. So for instance, if we wanted to load in a new brush, I could click the open button and then go to where I keep all of my brushes. And I've got quite a few of them. And we'll take this one called Skies. They're like sort of pixel maps of really, really large skies. I can test them out within the brush edit palette in this little temporary canvas here. So what I will do is I'll go back here and I will look through my brushes. So I'm going to select, again, sort of an off-white, sort of yellow tone. Make a new layer and position it just under a cloud, and now I've got like this heavenly sort of beam of light, which probably could be a little bit larger. I want this to be really large. Okay, let's say I want to reposition this layer. So that's a good example. So there's a layer menu, and you can certainly do all kinds of things there, but what you really probably want, and this is just kind of like typical graphic sort of application familiarity, but there is a move tool here over on the left. And if you hover over it, it says move a layer, so you know what it is. But it's a crosshair, and if you use it, then you can grab the entire layer and move it around, just like you would in any other graphical software. So now I've got this sort of for free streaks of light coming out of this cloud. You could do this manually, but since I found a brush that had it, I'm just using it, which is kind of nice. Now, that's not all you can do with brush editing. You can go into the brush editor mode, and there are lots of different, you've got auto brushes, predefined brushes, custom brushes, clipboard brush, so anything that's in your clipboard you can actually use as a brush, and text brush, which is really about the only way that Krita has to generate text, which is kind of a little bit strange, I admit, but I guess they assume you're not going to be doing a lot of typography in this. And indeed, I'm not going to. I want to actually use a very special font that I have, so I'm clicking the ellipsis button on my text brush, and it brings up the standard KDE font selection menu. So I will go into my font selection, select Open Logos. I'll use Regular. Now, these are weird. You can't actually resize the text very well. So I'm making it huge. It's a huge brush now. And you can probably tell from the outline what exactly this is. I'm going to give it its own layer, though. And then I will select black, or maybe a little bit less than black again. Solid black, solid white, that sort of thing very rarely happens in nature. So I'm painting my little object, which turns out to be, dear audio listeners, a tux. That is the penguin. So I'm repositioning him with my layer tool again. So he's transparent right now, but he's sitting under the heavenly light, which is good. But he doesn't need to be transparent. So underneath him, I will make another layer and go in with my brush again. So I have that mapped to B, the B key. I don't think that's what it is by default, so beware. And now This is a good place to show you the basic set. So basic brushes are a little bit atypical of Krita, but they're as you can see, video people, they're basically 100%. I mean, they're not 100%. It depends on how you have them set, but they're fairly solid. Because it's a big pixel brush. It's just a bunch of pixels. You're painting it, whatever color you're painting it. So again, I'm getting just a little bit off white / semi yellow gray, and then I'm going to paint right behind Tux here, so that he seems a little bit more solid, and less like a transparent outline of himself. And I'm trying more or less to keep inside the lines, but let's be honest, we don't really care. Okay, there. And of course, if we did really care, and maybe we do, we could make this a little bit smaller with the left bracket. We could switch over to erase mode, and then erase around the edges there. And of course, you could get really creative and paint his feet and beak a different color, and because the bottom of his beak is away from the light, we'll give it a little bit of shading. This is the pencil texture, and it acts a little bit, I would say, like a colored pencil. I mean, maybe I'm saying a colored pencil because I'm in colored mode, but that's what I've always thought they meant. So that's good for shading, I find, but I mean, I'm sure a really talented artist could probably do really anything with it. So we'll save what we've got, which I've done, and then exporting is, as you would expect, file export. By default, the files that you save from Krita are .kra, that's the Krita extension, but of course we could just give it the PNG format, and it will convert it for us. It'll offer all kinds of different things. Save as index.png, as far as I know, Krita doesn't actually do that, so that's not much use. PNG interlaced the current profile, and we'll say okay. And there you go. So that's basically Krita, I think. Lots of fun, interesting tools to use, I think you'll agree. Even if you're not a great artist, which I'm really not, then there's probably something that Krita can do for you. It's just a lot of fun to play around with, and I think that it's got enough features that it really kind of makes you look a lot better than you are. I mean, I'm not saying this is a great work of art as it is, but I am saying that it's a heck of a lot better than what I could have done without Krita's help. Hopefully that was helpful.
And thank you for watching the show. This is the end of the show, so I will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation, .org. And you can also find me on linuxquestions.org as notklaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.